ערוץ 7.
Israel National Radio presents Walter's World, the hard-hitting program that brings the news behind the news, with no-holds-barred interviews that get to the core of the matter, as well as on-site reports of current events. Hosted by the Doyen of the Airwaves, Israel National Radio's senior broadcaster, Walter Bingham.
Hello and welcome to an additional program for the week that began on February the 17th. I am Walter Bingham. In today's program, you'll hear about some of the interesting official receptions that are being held at the residence of our President, Reuven Rivlin. Also, as Israel will go to elections on April the 9th, we shall bring you, during the next few weeks, a series of discussion programs with leaders of or officials from different political parties to help you make sense of the many changes. Today, we begin with a general overview of our political and electoral system by two highly knowledgeable and respected commentators. But first, this announcement. If you are planning to spend Pesach in Israel or a vacation at any other time, inquire about My Little Home in Jerusalem, which is now available. It's a new, luxury, strictly kosher one-bedroom apartment that sleeps four, with all possible conveniences, situated in a brand-new building in fashionable Baka, within walking distance of the Old City and close to the Old Station Entertainment Complex. For more information, phone 972-54-736-1711 or email My Little Home in Jerusalem, that's one word, at gmail.com. Our ambassador to the United Nations, His Excellency Danny Danon, has for the second time brought a delegation of 40 of his ambassadorial colleagues from the UN on a fact-finding tour to Israel. They met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and were received by President Reuven Rivlin at his residence. Here is some of what the president told them.
I say that I'm very excited to meet all of you, the representative of your people at the United Nations. When we are talking people to people, it's much better, it's much deeper when we are meeting all together. You came to our State of Israel. We are celebrating 70 years of the independence. The land of Israel is the fatherland of the Jewish people, not against somebody, but in favor of the real historical fact that we have no other fatherland but the land of Israel. We lived in harmony until Zionism became a political movement. Then the conflicts began. We didn't have a real conflict with the Palestinians, because no one really related to them as people who needs a state. There were Egyptians, there were Syrians, there were Iraqians, but we were here. You are coming just now from Majdanek. Majdanek is not only tragic, but horrible chapter of our people. But I would like you to know that the State of Israel was not established as compensation to the Holocaust. Not at all. The State of Israel was established, first of all, because it is our fatherland. And we came here because we have no other place to get to. Unfortunately, we had to move from place to place because people have said to us all the time, why don't you go to your fatherland, to the Bible promised land, to Israel, until we realized that maybe they are on the right side. All your people have told us, go. And establish your own state. And we did so. And we did so, and in the last 70 years, we, for ourselves, realized a sort of miracle, because now we are 7 million Jews that we have absorbed from all over the world. They came here, people from 70 languages. Now more than 14 million people all over the world are talking Hebrew fluently. Because we managed to understand that we have to bridge the gap of 2,000 years that we were absent here. and to do everything in spite of all the challenges that we were facing during the time, absorbing people who carry the burden of security. Now we have to feed the people of the zone, which are almost 9 million Israelis, about 5 million Palestinians. We are trying to do everything in order to achieve to the hearts of our cousins, neighbors, the Palestinians, not with a lot of success. We are dealing with a conflict that could not be solved. And there are many things that we can solve by creating and building confidence between us and the Palestinians, and that is the task. Pressure will not bring to build confidence. Pressure will bring us to be more stubborn and bring the Palestinians to be more stubborn. Because if the Palestinians believe that they can solve the problem with putting pressure on Israel, they will find out immediately that it is impossible. But, of course, what we have done here, at the time that I was born, there was only one university. Now we have 11 universities. Three of them are out of the 100 best universities in the world. And we are doing a lot in the culture. We are doing a lot with the medical needs for all people. And we are doing a lot because we have related to every challenge that we had to confront and to face an opportunity. And we did so. Fortunately, we can share the whole world with our know-how. We are now cooperating with Africa, with India, with Vietnam. We are cooperating with all of Europe. It's not only a matter of security and know-how under the pressure of the need to carry the burden of security. As an outcome for the economical needs and from the academic needs and from the health needs of every one of us. And the world now is a very small village. We are all together and we can help one each other. Sometimes when we watch decisions at the United Nations, we're wondering how come politicians can really decide upon the historical fact, like what have happened in the Holocaust. Or is there a connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem? This is almost something that is showing ignorance, but you know, it's something that I'd like to avoid and not to relate to the historical fact. Everyone knows, everyone. Nevertheless, UNESCO getting a resolution saying that there is no connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem. Well, we were praying 2,000 years to God to return us back to Jerusalem, which means that we had some connection. The shield of David is serving the Israeli people and the Jews for the last 3,000 years when David came to Jerusalem. We have archaeological proofs that everyone can see. Since 1967, everyone can worship God in Jerusalem according to his belief, whether he is Christian, Muslim, every Jew, and we are keeping the right of everyone to have the ability to worship God according to his own belief freely in Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem united is something that brings the ability to every human being all over to really relate to Jerusalem as the city of God. And that could be only under one sovereignty with the understanding. With the understanding of everyone. And we are doing a lot in order to say and to really prove the whole world, and Danny, you are doing a great job, that there is no gap whatsoever between Israel as a Jewish state and Israel as a democratic one. We have 120 members of Knesset. Out of 120 members, there are 16 Muslims, 3 Druze, and 1 Christian. I was lucky to be the Speaker of the Knesset for almost 10 years. I can assure you that no one have dared even to say that any resolution, it's not legitimate because Arab members of Knesset were part of the vote and part of the majority. No way. Because really, we believe that the Jewish state have the need and the idea and the value that every citizen is equal. It is not a democratic state for the Jews. It is a democratic state for all the citizens. We are not proving it. We are living according to our values.
With me now is our own ambassador to the United Nations, Mr. Danny Danon. Welcome to the program.
Shalom, shalom.
You've brought all these UN ambassadors here to Israel for the second time. You brought a group, and you're very close to them. So how do you perceive their impressions of Israel and how they feel?
It's amazing to see the difference between the ambassadors who have visited Israel and those who haven't yet. When they come here, they see the facts. So right here from Jerusalem, we're going to fly up north. They will see the tunnels of Hezbollah. We speak a lot about the Iranians, about funding terrorism. Today they will actually see it. They met the president of Israel, they will meet the prime minister, and for us it is a great opportunity to show them the real face of Israel. Those ambassadors, when they will come back to New York, they will have a full understanding of the threats that we are dealing with. And also, one day, they will be head of countries, they will be minister of foreign affairs, and they will remember the week they learned and spent in Israel.
Those that you brought the last time, have you noticed any difference in their attitude?
Absolutely. A few weeks ago, with the Ambassador Nikki Haley, we presented a resolution to condemn Hamas in the General Assembly. We got 87 votes supporting this resolution, compared to 57 who voted against us. Many of those who joined us were ambassadors who came to Israel. Others abstained that used to vote against us. So it's a process, it's a marathon, and for the long time, we believe we'll see more and more countries joining us.
You're doing a wonderful job. Everybody said so, even the president. But let me change tack. You had an opportunity to become a member of Knesset, and you turned that down and you decided you would like to continue in the United Nations. Why is that?
In my position as the Israeli ambassador to the UN, you have a lot of responsibility. And coming here for the elections, they would have to leave everything immediately. And we had things on the table, the mission to Israel, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, a Palestinian initiative for full recognition at the UN. And I felt it was irresponsible to do it, but I can guarantee you, I will be back. I'll be back to public service in Israel. I intend to complete my tenure as the Israeli ambassador and come back, you know, when time will decide to start again supporting Israel, not from the UN.
Danny Danon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now I am with one of the co-sponsors of this meeting of UN ambassadors, Mr. Richard Heidemann of the Zionist Federation of the United States. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm president of the American Zionist Movement, and together with the International March of the Living, we hosted the UN ambassadors first in Poland. We took them to Majdanek. We took them to the Poland Museum. They were participating in various aspects of understanding the depths of the tragedy and the horror of the Holocaust. They walked together into not just a concentration camp, but into a gas chamber.
What were their reactions?
Many of them were not only so very sad, but they were shocked to experience the reality of standing in Majdanek under a shower head and to then look across and literally see the canisters of Zyklon B. The experience they had in seeing the shoes of the real people who were murdered there brought home to each of them that we're not talking about just numbers. We're talking about people, men and women and children, not only the Jewish people, but others who were murdered in the Holocaust.
I'm very glad that you brought these ladies and gentlemen, UN ambassadors, here.
Thank you. So my wife, Phyllis Greenberg Heidemann, who's here with the president, has led the March of the Living with Dr. Shmuel Rosenman, and 260,000 people have gone through the experience of participating in the March of the Living. In the American Zionist Movement, we have 29 organizational members in the United States, included in which we have almost 3 million members of the American Jewish community. So these two organizations, working with Ambassador Danny Danone at the United Nations, put together this second delegation of UN ambassadors to come first to Poland and then on to Israel, to understand the depths and horrors of the Holocaust, and now to understand the richness and wonders of life here in Israel.
Thank you very much for talking to Israel National Radio.
This week also saw the state visits to Israel of Austrian President Alexander Van der Bellen. He and his wife Doris were also received at the residence of Israel's President Reuven Rivlin. After a ceremonial welcome with a band of Israel's police and an inspection of the IDF honor guard, both presidents and their wives greeted and shook hands with a lineup of VIPs. It all took place in brilliant sunshine before we all moved into the Great Hall to hear the welcome statement of President Rivlin and the Austrian president's reply. It was all in Hebrew and German, so I can only bring you the most significant sentences in my English translation. I have long admired the ability of President Rivlin to find the right content of his speeches according to the international statesmen, whether they are state presidents or ambassadors, or the profile of any groups he is addressing. In outlining some of Israel's achievements in the framework of being a Jewish and democratic state, President Rivlin referred to the cooperation between Austria and Israel, and he then said that Israel will not compromise its values or security of its citizens, and we wish for the day when Israel can live in peace with all its neighbors. The Iranian regime, he said, is the main cause of the instability and the spreading of terror in Europe and the Near East. The Iranian regime is for us an enemy that wants the destruction of Israel. It is our duty to take this threat seriously, and we value the contribution Austria's to the security and stability of the region. Your participation in UNIFIL attests to this, he told the Austrian president. But we need to stop the aggression of Hezbollah so that we are not dragged into a war. On the 27th of January, we observed International Holocaust Memorial Day, but regrettably, anti-Semitism has not disappeared, but raises its head everywhere in the world and especially during the past year. During the past year, there were approximately 50 anti-Semitic incidents in your country, according to the police. But at the same time, the Austrian government is supporting the European initiative in the fight against anti-Semitism, and it would really be disastrous if Jews in Europe would have again to be frightened to freely express their Judaism. The international definition of anti-Semitism has been fully accepted by Austria, and we must uncompromisingly deal with anti-Semitism. This is not a Jewish struggle. It is one for a unified struggle of humanity. In his reply, President van der Bellen referred to Theodor Herzl, an Austrian, as an important connection between Austria and Israel. But we are also connected by a cruel history, he remarked. Today, at Yad Vashem, I want to memorialize the attempt of the complete destruction of European Jewry. Tens of thousands of Austrian Jews have been murdered by the Nazi regime, and even more were chased away. Let me say and repeat without misunderstanding, Austria has joint responsibility for the Holocaust. Many Austrian men and women were among the perpetrators. Also, because of that, we bow in humility before the victims. Austria has admitted its responsibility late, very late, which made our relations difficult for a long time. I'd like to add that Israel is a fortification of democracy and freedom here in the Near East. Austria, on the other hand, is surrounded by friends, and I'm impressed that you practice and maintain your democracy, a multifaceted and lively democracy. That, too, binds us. The fight against anti-Semitism and racism has always been a strong personal desire, as it is also for me today. We Austrians know that anti-Semitism and Nazism did not suddenly descend from heaven. It was present in Austrian society even before. The Holocaust was but the culmination of what existed before. Therefore, there cannot be any tolerance towards anti-Semitism. It is our aim that Jewish life is possible, secure, and unimpeded everywhere, whether in Israel, Europe, or anywhere else. It is our aim that Jews can live in security and peace wherever they live. That is our wish. That is our responsibility. That is, as Austrians, our debt to the victims of the Holocaust. I believe that I can say that it is in Austria the national desire that Israel will be able to live in peace. President van der Bellen then listed the achievements of our relations and continued, "We used to view each other from a distance, which has now become a togetherness. In that sense, that we understand each other, we shall open new avenues of cooperation." That does, of course, not mean that we have always to be of the same view in all matters, to value and respect each other. That was the strongest and most powerful admission of guilt by any European leader whose country has, to a larger or lesser degree, been involved in prosecuting the Holocaust. Now to the first of our series of election programs, with a general overview given by Yaron Dekel, who was the correspondent of Israel TV in Washington, and more recently the CEO and editor-in-chief of Galit Zahal, the very popular and most listened to IDF radio station. With him is Professor Gideon Rahat, political scientist from the Hebrew University and senior fellow of the Israel Democracy Institute, expert on our political and electoral system. Two very knowledgeable and respected commentators. The first to speak is Yaron Dekel.
In my career, I was a political reporter and commentator in different media outlets here in Israel, mainly in the public channel, Channel 1, and then in Galei Tzal, the IDF radio. And this will be the 11th election which I cover in different positions in Israeli media. And I like politics. It's a profession, but it's also a hobby. What I'm going to say represents obviously what I think about and see in the Israeli campaign. And as many as journalists we are in Israel, and the same number of views you can have. I think the main question, which is quite clear so far, is what is the main or single issue of the 2019 election campaign and who sets the agenda of the campaign. So far, the agenda is very simple. Netanyahu yes or Netanyahu no. Can Netanyahu continue as a prime minister of Israel, or there's going to be a change in the coalition and the government in the election on April the 9th. On July, Netanyahu is going to break the Israeli record and will be the longest prime minister ever. And all the polls so far show that he has the greatest chance to form the next coalition. I think he is the best politician in Israel right now. He's one of the most experienced politicians. And he knows what campaign is and how to set the agenda. And he managed so far to set the agenda on him. Netanyahu is the issue, not security, social issues, economy, health system, nothing of the above. Palestinian is not on the table unless there is something from Gaza. But Netanyahu is the issue. Netanyahu, investigation, corruption, general attorney, Netanyahu, Netanyahu, Netanyahu. That's the issue. And he believes, and I would agree with him, that if you set the agenda, you get a few good numbers of the popularity. If you know how to set the agenda, everybody else follows you and gets a bonus in the campaign, in the ballot. So we know what's the issue so far, Netanyahu, and we know what is absent from the campaign. And one word is totally absent, which was very popular in the past. And the word is peace. Nobody talks about peace anymore. Nobody promises peace. Nobody promises agreement with the Palestinians or obviously with Syria. And I think we are still at the aftermath of the 2006 engagement from Gaza, which was orchestrated by late Prime Minister Sharon, who was the builder of the settlements and then made a U-turn without explaining why he decided and evacuate 8,500 settlers from their homes and destroying all the settlements unilaterally, pulling out from Gaza Strip. Why do I think we are in the aftermath of 2006 disengagement? Because this broke a lifetime-long equation in the Israeli politics and mindset. Peace for territory, or territory for peace. It worked with Egypt. We thought it might work with the Palestinian in the Oslo Accord. But people believe that once you give territory, you get something which is called peace. The average Israeli who supported and those who were opposed the disengagement saw something totally different and discovered that this equation is not valid anymore. Because through the Israeli mindset, once you get out from a territory, you don't receive rockets in return. That's the average Israeli, because you are not there, so there is no reason to attack you. No soldier, no settler, no home, nothing. Even the cemeteries were taken out. And people started asking questions. What terms you give back a territory to an Arab side? And the word peace was very popular in the 80s, 90s, and only Sharon will bring peace was his slogan in 2001 when he was running to the prime ministership against Ehud Barak, the acting prime minister. Is not valid anymore because Netanyahu and Prime Minister Barak, who said that Arafat is not a partner, managed to convince the average Israeli that there is no partner. So if there is no partner, there is no reason to promise any solution, any peace, or any agreement with the other side. And I think it's very important to understand when we look at the political system and the political arena, because there was a shift of the Israelis with a huge bulk of being in the center to move slightly towards the center right. And then I am always asked, is there a chance that someone from the other camp will be elected to prime minister and form a coalition? I cannot look to the future, I'm not a prophet, but I can look back to the history and I see that in the last quarter of a century, there were two times the Labour Party chairman was elected to be a prime minister. And they have two things in common, Rabin and Barak. Both were army chief of staff. That's one of the reasons we see how parties are so eager for generals. I was sure that after the second Lebanon war, that it will be quicker the look for generals, because two civilians managed the war, Prime Minister Olmert and Minister of Defense Amir Peretz, and it will be decades that the Israelis will look for general to be in one of the positions of Prime Minister or Minister of Defense. So both Barak and Rabin were Army Chief of Staff in their career, and both of them were blamed to pretend being from the Likud in their campaign by their own supporters. Barak was called Bibi Twin, and Rabin was called Likud B by his followers, because they were too aggressive for their home camp. And it means they both put masks on their faces when they were running to the office of not being such a dovish prime ministers as they were during their term, both Rabin and Barak, but being much more hawkish on the center-right. And both of them were successful. It was before 2006 and the shift of the public opinion, which means that the chance of a leftist, if he is not a general, hawkish, pretended to be a Likud member, to be elected is very, very low. Yeah. Unless Netanyahu makes a major mistake, because we know sometimes an acting president loses and someone takes the office. George Bush's father attacked Iraq, and people said that 92 election campaign in America is gone, is over, because Bush was going to be reelected. And then he made the mistakes with the taxes, and there was an unknown governor from Arkansas, and he became a president for 8 years. Who thought that someone from Arkansas will be the president of the United States? It could be a joke. But an acting president loses, and someone is there to pick up the office. So A, Netanyahu, he is very careful not to make mistakes. He lost power once in 99, and he doesn't want to lose power twice. Second factor that could be important is connected to the security. Something happened with Gaza, with the initiative of the Hamas or the Islamic Jihad, provocation which could go furthermore into an Israeli operation, insecurity, and people feel insecure, and some losses to the Israeli side. And you can see a shift in the public opinion because Netanyahu gives the impression to the Israeli public that he is the best man to keep their security. And the last thing is the corruption issue with the question of the general attorney indictment. If he comes with the indictment before the elections, so far we saw no influence to the matter of corruption on the Israeli public, which means we might use to the fact that politicians could be blamed in corruption and we still trust them in terms of security. But if we look a few months back to the municipal elections, we saw that in many cities, corruption did play a role, and those who were blamed in corruption were kicked out of office. Now, not that when you choose a mayor, it's the same way when you choose a party. And last point, how do Israelis vote, and why do we don't see major shifts in Israeli politics? I think it's not a matter of ratio, but it's a matter of emotion and guts. When you enter to the ballot, ask one major question. Whom do I trust? And then they don't find the name Avi Gabay or Yair Lapid on the ballot to answer this question. Benny Gantz is a new figure in the horizon of Israeli politics. We have a few examples of generals who succeeded in Israeli politics, but we have more examples of generals who failed. With no political experience, and politics is a profession, it's not easy to jump from the office of the Army Chief of Staff to the Prime Ministership. Like mushrooms after the rain, every week we see a new party. Why is it? Why does it happen? Israeli politics was always full with divisions. We always had relatively high number of political parties. And the reason is, first, the Israeli society is divided into many different tribes. Second is the electoral system, a nationwide electoral district, proportional representation, a threshold which is now moderate, 3.25. We always had this fragmentation. Then in the end of the 90s, we had a direct election for the prime minister that donated its share for the fragmentation of Israeli politics. People in Israel had two ballots, one to vote for the prime minister, one to vote for a political party. And Israelis are not suckers, so if you have two ballots, you don't give them to the prime minister and to his party, you give it to another party to make your point. And even though this was cancelled, now we vote for a single ballot to the Knesset, we still have some remains of this division. And what we have now that intensified this division, and you could hear Yaron and see that it's all over, the personalization of politics. We are not talking about political parties anymore. We are talking about what you said, Netanyahu, yes and no. But not only this. If I wake up in the morning and I want to create a party and I want to join politics, in the good old days, I would join a party. Now what you do is you create your own party and then you say, okay, maybe I can make an alliance with you or something like this. So the personalization of politics in Israel is absolutely crazy. And this is in a system in which you elect political parties, and this is in a parliamentary system in which at the end of the day, it's about coalition government that is created from many different political parties. I would add to this that I'm not sure that it's good for Netanyahu to be seen as the only issue in these elections because of the following reason. Netanyahu is not popular like having 55 or 60% support from the population. His leadership is strong because he has much more support than any other alternative. But I wouldn't say that even in opinion polls that appear in Israel Hayom, which is almost his
newspaper, he doesn't get close to 50% support in the population. So if Netanyahu says it's about me, and if people will treat it as direct election for the prime minister, we might end up with Likud losing votes because people would say, okay, Netanyahu is going to be the prime minister anyhow. And in the last few days, Shas said they will support him. Lieberman said they will support him. Why did they say it? They say it because they want people to vote for them and not for Likud. So at the end of the day, if we see this kind of development, and if it wouldn't stop in any point, we might end up with Likud losing seats, too many of the parties around it. Now, for Netanyahu, it's not so bad. I think that Netanyahu is very happy with coalition government. He doesn't want to see any threat, even not from his own party. But the election results might be really crazy if this is the dynamic. We will have here many political parties with 5, 6, 10, 20 seats. So there is a possibility for this dynamic. Of course, the dynamic can be different. That's what Netanyahu did in the previous elections. This Geval campaign in the last few days. In the last few days, we do not have opinion polls anymore. So every election, we have what we see as a surprise. Okay, 2006, it was the Pensioners' Party, which is... But in 2009, it was CP versus BB, and then Labour Party and Meretz collapsed. In 2013, it was Lapid group. I think what is really interesting about Israeli voters is that the blocs are very stable. You can hardly see people move from the right to the left or from the left to the right. It takes years to happen. People move to the right, but it takes years. However, within the same blocs, you see people change their vote from one election to the other in very high levels, higher than any other country that I know. Every elections here, you may say we have earthquake. People are moving and voting for other parties, especially young people. They are not like old people vote for the same party maybe all of their life. This is a different generation. They change their vote, but within their own camp. So you cannot really know what's going on until the last day. We also have a threshold, 3.25, which might be very, very important. Imagine that the votes are spread. Let's say three parties on the right would get 3% of the vote and would not pass the threshold. So 9% of the votes wouldn't count. So we have all of these variables. It makes it interesting, but it makes it really hard to know what will happen at the end. I would put my bet, like Yaron did, on Netanyahu. But there are scenarios in which he can find himself really having a hard time to build his coalition. Let's imagine that the right is losing 9% of the votes because of the reasons that I said. So the key, number 60 and number 61 seats are in the hands, let's say, of Benny Gantz. So what I'm saying is that different things can happen. The person who decides who will be the prime minister is, at least theoretically, the person who holds number 60 and 61 seats in the Knesset. Imagine the Knesset is going from the left to the right, okay? On the extreme left, you have the Arab parties, Meretz, Labor, then all of these centrist parties. Nobody knows where to locate them. They don't know also, so we cannot do it anyhow. And then you have the classical right, the Likud, the religious parties that are with the Likud, the new right. So we have two blocks, and in between them, this center. Now, if this center captures the center, we have different ball game than if the block of the right captures the center. In the previous elections, the center was captured by Kahlon. Kahlon could theoretically go with the left. However, it is not legitimate in the current Israeli system to be supported by the Arab parties, by the non-Zionist parties. So if you do not count them, the center, the key was in the hands of the Likud, actually. So the elections at the end of the day are elections between political parties. And the day after, you have to ask yourself, not the question which is the largest party. The most important question is which is the largest bloc. I'm just remembering the 2009 elections. So journalists from the world are calling me and they tell me, Tzipi Livni has won the elections. And I tell them, no, Tzipi Livni did not win the elections. We don't have direct election here. Because Kadima had 28 seats and Likud had 27. That's not the question. The question is which bloc has the largest number of seats. And after 2009 election, it was clear that the right plus religious parties have a majority. And this was the important thing for the question, who will be the prime minister, who will build the government. This fragmentation is important. You want me to ask the other
question? One important question is why corruption doesn't play a major role so far.
If you ask people in Israel, like many people around the world, which is something that is funny and also irritating, which institutions do you trust? People all over the democratic world do not trust the institutions that they elect. People do not trust political parties, they do not trust parliaments, they do not trust the government. They tend to trust the courts, they tend to trust the military, in Israel for sure, less the police. We have this in Israel and abroad. So I think that in a way people say to themselves, all politicians are corrupted, therefore I will not put corruption in my equation. This is, in my opinion, a sad story, and it's not only playing for the good of the right, for the right in Israel, maybe. It would be better if they wouldn't think that their only hope is Netanyahu. Sometimes you should ask, maybe there are people on the right which cannot be even alleged for corruption. But corruption is there. And as an Israeli, when I talk to people from abroad, on the one hand, I'm ashamed that we already had a president and a prime minister and minister of treasury in jail. And on the other hand, and counting, and on the other hand, I'm very proud of my country that shows you that we have the rule of law. So my hope is that the rule of law will continue. That if Netanyahu has done wrong, he will get his punishment. And if not, of course, he shouldn't get his punishment, because the rule of law is not only about putting people in jail, it's also not putting them there if they are not to be blamed.
Can I tell you a story? In the last municipal election, I asked my granddaughter if she could vote who she would vote for. And she said, for Hochberger the thief. Yes, everybody knows he's a thief, but he's a good mayor.
What could happen that could change the scene? If there is a competition now between two parties, who gets retired General Gabi Ashkenazi? And the reason is that both Lapid and Gantz believe that if Ashkenazi joined them, he will get the votes of the other side of Gantz, in case of Lapid, or he gets the votes of Lapid if he joins from Gantz. Let's assume it happens, and for the game, Ashkenazi will join Gantz, and Gantz will jump from 16 to 20 in the ballots, and Lapid from 16 to 8. He will try to bring Lapid till February the 21st, when you have to present the parties to the election committee, and it's the last date. And let's assume he managed, and you have Gantz, Ashkenazi, and Lapid. Now, we don't see them anymore. But we couldn't see Livni and Herzog in 2015. And suddenly it happened. And then Netanyahu felt that he is in a risk and he is in a danger. That's why the reason why he said that the Arabs are rushing to the polls on the day of the elections, because he thought that the Livni-Herzog combination is a threat. Now, we don't see it at the moment, because we see 10, 12, 16, 5, and Netanyahu with a 32. But Israeli politics could present some surprises sometimes. So here is one of them.
There's a huge problem of legitimacy, and I don't see the Arab parties also support any Zionist government. They weren't even ready to make an agreement with Meretz. But if the Arab, the so-called joint list, if it will really be divided and if the two heads would pass, it might be possible in a specific scenario to see, let's say, one of these heads, maybe Tibi, support from outside, or support from outside, meaning you will have minority coalition, which they wouldn't take part in the coalition, but they wouldn't vote against them. And in Israeli system, if you want to replace a government, you need to have an alternative government. So basically, these are scenarios that if. But all of these ifs might be there, and my thesis goes against the thesis of most people in the system. My argument is that Netanyahu have a better chance if there is a clear alternative to him. If Netanyahu runs against this alliance of Lapid and Gantz and all of these, he will be more successful, in my opinion. He will focus on them. He will bring his base back to him. If the picture stays like it is right now, so people are saying, like in direct election for the prime minister, well, it is clear that Netanyahu is going to be the next prime minister. He has 30 seats, the next party have 15 seats, and basically most of the people think about politics as a horse race, and also that's what they read in the newspapers, because people are using the American frames of the horse race, even though it's not absolutely true for Israel. So if Netanyahu is running against 10 different political parties, some on his right, some on his left, some more religious, some more other identities, I think he would be in trouble. Who would he attack? And the campaign in Israel is mainly negative. I don't see a lot of positive campaigns here. Sometimes I ask myself, why Netanyahu is not doing a positive campaign? Because basically you can argue that Israeli economy is in a good shape. You can say that in terms of security, it's not that we live in heaven, but we don't have huge terrorist attack. We have troubles, but I'm always asking myself, why doesn't he take a step back and say, I'm the leader of this great country, etc.? And I see that all of the things that happen are more of the negative.
Because he believes that the negative campaign is more convincing and more influential than a positive campaign. Finkelstein's theory in 1996 said, doing a harsh negative campaign, Peres will split Jerusalem, Barak will split Jerusalem. So it's the same campaign since 1996, blaming the left of being unpatriotic. And the second is being a Jewish prime minister. Arthur Finkelstein told Netanyahu in 96 that he should ask, how do you define yourself as an Israeli voter? Are you more Jewish or more Israeli? Those who say they are more Jewish are your voters. Those who say that they are Israelis, they are not your voters. And from that came the campaign Netanyahu is good for the Jewish people in 96. And in 97, the left thought they forgot what it is to be Jewish. And to the Arabs are rushing to the polls. It's the same Arthur Finkelstein method from 1996. In all of his campaign, he hasn't changed in his campaign.
And also you have to remember that electoral turnout has to do with competition. If people will be convinced that Netanyahu will win anyhow, that's one thing. If they will feel that there is competition there, they might come also to vote. So there are so many variables there, and it's not about reality, it's about the image of reality, the image of competition, the image of should I stay home or should I vote for Netanyahu? Not because I like him, but because if I wouldn't go to vote, the Arabs will take over.
And that brings me to the end for today. I do hope that the items I've brought you will find resonance with you. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to me to walter.israelnationalradio@gmail.com. You will always get a reply. You can also post your comments on my program page, just below some pictures. Until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you a good week. And if you have any comment or suggestions, please write to me to walter.israelnationalradio@gmail.com. You'll always get a personal reply. You can also express your thoughts on the comment area, just below some pictures on my program page. Now, imagine you are housebound or have mobility problems. It is unbearably hot outside and you are alone and nobody comes to see if you are okay. Some of the elderly have to decide whether to spend their pension money on medicine, food, or perhaps a cooling fan. Imagine yourself in that position, and if you are able to, you have a duty to help your elderly neighbor. I am 95 and thankfully very fit in body and mind. But I know many old people who really need your help. So please look in on your elderly neighbor. Goodbye.
Yeah.